Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to War College, a weekly podcast that brings you the stories from behind the front lines. Here are your hosts.
Hello, welcome to War College. I'm Matthew Galt, and I have some new voices to introduce you to. First up is Derek Gannon. Derek?
How are you guys? How's everybody doing?
And I've also got Kevin Nodell here with me. Kevin, how are you doing?
Doing all right.
So as you guys know from last episode, Jason Fields is gone, and the War College is going to be changing up a little bit. The first big change is that Derek and Kevin are going to be joining me. Derek is going to be a co-host. Kevin is going to be an associate producer and voice of God in the background, helping us get guests, figure out what we need to talk about, and do quick Google searches in the background to fact-check us in the moment, hopefully. But let's learn a little bit more about who the hell these people are. Derek, who are you?
That is a very good question. I think a lot of people keep asking me that. Who are you? Hi, I'm Derek. I'm a 16-year Army veteran. Finished my career out in this U.S. Army Special Forces. I was a Green Beret with 5th Special Forces Group. Got out, worked in the medical field for a little bit, figured I really liked writing and wanted to continue to do that, and kind of just started using my analytical skills and threat hunting skills that they teach you in Special Forces to just kind of see if I could pivot that to journalism. And it worked out for a while, and then, you know, it just, journalism is hard. I like podcasting better, and I moved on, and then I decided to stupidly go back to college for a degree in information security and cybersecurity. So pretty much was a ground pounder for most of my life, and now I smack keyboards and pretend to be an internet tough guy for my twilight years. So that's pretty much me. I do focus a lot on the African region, the Syria region, Middle East a little bit, and I've started to kind of really enjoy kind of a hobby deep dive of Eastern Europe, like Poland, Latvia, the Russian influences there, and then obviously my favorite people of all people is China and their cyber warriors that they have going on. So I've been kind of deep diving that.
That's right, because I always forget, and you always remind me that you're something of a cyber maven. You run Linux on your laptop. Is that correct?
I run Linux on everything, but right now, God, okay. All right, Matt, I run Linux on everything. I'm one of those Linux people that's like, you should do Linux. But right now, the funny thing is everyone's going to laugh at this, is that I'm running all of this communication, recording, microphone, Skype, everything through a Windows 10 virtual machine. So I don't know if I'm like a Linux elite, because I'm just like, you know, it's just easier to run some shit through Windows. But yeah, I run Linux. I've been doing it for about 5 years. I took a course. Well, I got sent to a course when I was in the Special Forces that kind of exposed me to the whole like Linux, cybersecurity, you know, Backbox. I'm an older guy, so it's like, in, you know, hacking was still magical back then, and they started to introduce that as a, you know, a tool in the toolbox, if you will, as an adjunct for intelligence collection and significant actions, and just how to matriculate that data. Because even back in before I retired, we started realizing that people were moving to the cyber realm, to the matrix, if you will. So we kind of needed to get ahead of that. And I still went to weapons schools. You know, I was still a cool guy. Like, look at me. Kevin knows. Kevin's probably laughing in the background at me. He's like, yeah, you know, I had the sunglasses. I had the guns, the painted guns and everything. But, secretly I was smacking keyboards and learning this stuff. And when I retired, I went to a special operations veteran owned news site. And I'll leave it at that. And I got introduced to a couple actual legit, I don't know what you call them, just OGs of the Matrix that were like, hey, I see some aptitude. And I got taken under the wings of a couple of these, you know, guys that work for the government doing this, you know, at the National Security Agency to other places. And they're like, try this. And it just kind of fell down the rabbit hole with it. Because, you know, one minute you're a direct action guy. I hate saying that. It sounds so bad. And the next minute you retire or you get out and you're just like, okay, there's an itch that still needs to be scratched. And I found that threat hunting on the web and using networking and social engineering and cybersecurity, all that stuff kind of, you know, helped me scratch that itch of target deck matriculation, hunting bad guys, you know, threat hunting, things like that. It just kind of kept the brain, you know, operational. Call of Duty can do only so much, right? You gotta branch out and do things like that.
I like that you made the Call of Duty joke before I did, because that is exactly where I was going.
It was almost like I sensed it coming, because honestly, you and I think I force you to talk about Blackout and Black Ops 4 more than I think you want to. But yeah, that's me in a nutshell. Like, so right now I'm in your neck of your old stomping ground, Matt, right now, going to probably your same college, finishing up. So I got accepted into a specific program for cyber security engineers. So like the 5 years I was mentored by these two cyber ninjas, I'm actually really happy, because I'm being challenged, but it's nothing that I haven't done yet. So it's just something new to do. It's something to keep the brain working and still, you know, give back, I guess. I don't really know what that means, anything. And we just had Christmas, so that giving spirit, I don't know.
So War College's new co-host is a Green Beret, former Green Beret cyber ninja. Kevin, what the hell are you?
That's an excellent question. I am a journalist. I don't know, you could introduce me a little bit.
But I wanted you to talk about yourself. You've got to learn to, you know, you have to learn to sell yourself. That's half of what being a journalist is, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I am a former contributing editor at warisboring.com. May it rest in peace. Currently a contributor at Playboy magazine and anybody else who's willing to pay me for stories. I've covered the Middle East also as well.
I think covering the Middle East is a bit of a short sell on what you were doing for us at War is Boring when you were...
Yeah, I was basically running field coverage for the anti-ISIS campaign, supervising a very small team of journalists, though I have to stress that I was not on the ground at the time. I was doing all of that remotely, which is an interesting look into our new digital media world, actually, in a lot of ways.
And you've written some books?
Yes, I am a graphic novelist.
And some of you may remember Kevin and Derek have both been on the show before. Derek, I think you're talking, we talked to you about Africa once and Eric Prince once, right?
Yeah. I, with Robert Pelton, by the way, too. That was actually a really interesting show.
That was a good one. Yeah, that was definitely a good one. We ran that recently over the holidays.
I saw it. I re-listened to it. I was like, God, I sound like an idiot. But
you don't. Or if you do, you better shape up, because this is about to get real professional real fast.
It's about to get real. Yeah. I mean, I've known Kevin for, God, I think you were like one of the top first three journalists that were like, hey, you need to write.
How did you two meet?
Correct me if I'm wrong, Kev.
I
was working with James Laporta, who now works at Newsweek. Congrats, James. And I got connected with a Air Force special operations guy. And for the life of me, I don't remember his name. But he started this site called Blue Force Tracker. And I think I had...
Nolan Peterson, right?
Yeah, that's the guy. Nolan Peterson. Yeah, now he's in like the Ukraine doing some really in-depth stuff over there. And I think somehow I got introduced to Kevin. I think either you read something I had written...
Other way around. You found me on Twitter the Iraq coverage we were just talking about.
Right. And then we ended up realizing that we're from the same hometown. So then that helped.
Right.
God, yeah. And then I talked to David Axe, and I came over and I wrote this big piece, because I had actively offline been tracking Al-Shabaab. Like, Al-Shabaab became my, like, white whale. Actually, it started with Mokhtar Belmokhtar and Almar Boutain, and then it just moved over to East Africa.
Wait. Back up. Tell the audience who those two people are.
Oh, well, okay. So, Sheikh, I always screw that up. Mokhtar Belmokhtar was just, like, this OG Mujahideen from the CIA Afghan training camps, right? He just was this OG guy fighting the Russians in Afghanistan. But he still was a Salafist leaning kind of fella. And they call him the One Eye or the Marlboro Man. And the reason why they call him the One Eye is because he was screwing around in Afghanistan, I think in 82, literally juggling grenades. There's no bullshit. Like, he was training other Mooj how to use grenades before they went into the Stinger thing. And I don't know how he pulled a pin. I don't know what the hell he was doing, but he was juggling grenades and one went off and he lost his eye. So after that, he became a pretty high muckety muck in the initial phases of Al Qaeda, which was the Islamic Courts Union, ICC or something like that. But he's Algerian. He's an Algerian guy, and he went to Afghanistan to fight the Russians, got trained up, claimed. I'm saying claimed in past tense. That he knew Osama bin Laden. Like, he was in the bin Laden camps getting trained by the CIA to do all this other stuff. Long story short, sorry, I know a lot about this guy. It's super weird. He moves back to Africa, and he gets involved with the Islamic movement that was going on there and just became, like, a really high-up guy. And he was in, a lot of stuff, like the Ones Who Bathe in Blood group. He was the ringleader. I don't know if you guys remember the Sahel, where the French special forces had to go into one of their nuclear, had a mining operation for, I think, plutonium and other things like that. Like, some stuff that you could, like, yellow cake type of shit. Like, they were mining it somewhere in the Sahara. And Mokhtar Belmokhtar took his group of fighters and kidnapped and killed a bunch of people over there. It was a pretty bad scene. And he just became a bigger guy. And then he became, like, a head honcho. And he had Movement of Oneness, was another, group. And then the United States came in. Everybody remembers Arab Spring. So, Libya fell. And Mokhtar had married into, there's a tribe in Libya that Gaddafi absolutely loved, was the Tuaregs. They're like a Bedouin nomadic tribe. Well, he married into the Tuaregs have royalty. Mokhtar married one of his six wives, I think, was a princess of the Tuareg, some Tuareg tribe. As soon as Libya fell, Mokhtar became like a de facto, he just collected these guys. So he was a part of the weapons just leaving Libya. I mean, just, he was a part of smuggling that. Because the reason why he was called the Marlboro Man is because he sold everything from humans to his favorite thing to do was to steal Marlboro cigarettes and sell those in the black market in Mali and Gao. So I started focusing on that guy because that's an HVT1, and it was just kind of scratching that itch. I was like, wow, I worked in Africa before. I knew these. He created a supergroup, right? Like the Avengers of terrorism, called Al-Mor Boutin. And they just kind of started fluttering around. And they've always been there. Now, he's supposedly, the Department of Defense in CENTCOM says he's dead. He's been drone struck, I think, like 4 times. I used to call him Teflon Jihadi because they're like, yeah, Mokhtar's dead. And he'd pop up, do some gangster shit, and then disappear again. But no one's heard from him in about 2 years, so maybe he is dead. So that transitioned into where these guys were going and who were the biggest groups, terrorist organizations, because the GWAT is the GWAT, it's global war. The biggest group that I started kind of getting really into, almost romanticizing, which sounds horrible, was Harakat al-Shabaab, or the youth, or the al-Shabaab in Somalia, East Africa, which are in the news again for their Nairobi strike that they just did. They just did a whole suicide attack at a hotel in Nairobi. The al-Shabaab is in East Africa, and they're more of a nationalistic terrorist organization who had people that started them, like Sheikh Rabaul, Godani. The core group of these guys were also guys that were trained in Afghanistan. And they just came home. They're like, okay, the Russian stuff is done. They just came home, and they still continue to be, you know, strict Sharia Salafist Muslims.
That old story.
They just came home. They just went home. And that's the thing that I love about journalism as a whole, and even I'm a part of this problem too, is that the Twitter armchair NatSecers, national security, gurus, even to the general public, is like, okay, these folks are defeated, so they're gone. I think we think of wars as borders, like, okay, World War II was a border thing. Well, this is an insurgency, so they're like water. They just, okay, well, they just got their asses handed to them in Afghanistan, or Afghanistan's over. They go home, but they don't stop fighting. They don't stop with their ideology. And so, like, al-Shabaab became like a really interesting thing for me, especially in 2009 when they became ultra popular, but around in the late 2000s, they pledged, their fealty to bin Laden, because, he was still alive, still, and Zawahiri and al-Qaeda, and just became a massive terrorist problem in East Africa. I mean, it's from all of Somalia down into Kenya, Tanzania, they're everywhere. They've kind of, Ethiopia has a problem with them. It's in Somalia from Black Hawk down to now has always had issues. It's the quintessential failed state. And I don't know what else Somalians that I know are probably going to be upset that I said that, but it is a textbook model of a failed nation state due to its corrupt internal infrastructure, and then just being forced into issues of having had United Nations come in, or NATO come in with peacekeepers, and that just caused a whole other problems. And it's just al-Shabaab is kind of being a little bit quiet right now. I mean, this is the biggest move that he'd done, was the Nairobi operation.
All of this to say that Derek knows exactly what he's talking about.
Yeah, sorry. It's great. It's like, another one of my white whales. The issue, another thing too, what I find extremely interesting is Mokhtar Rabaul. Rabaul was one of the founding members of al-Shabaab, and he turned himself in 2017 to the Somali government. And, he's been living pretty well, mainly because he didn't want to take the al-Shabaab ideal of jihad global. He wanted to stay nationalistic. He wanted to have an African caliphate established in Somalia. And that is going directly against the core leadership of al-Shabaab right now. So they put a hit out on him. Al-Shabaab fights themselves a lot more than they fight, AMSOM or, the Somali federal government troops. Like they go around and schwack each other a lot. So Rabaul turned himself in. He took about, I think, 150 of his own loyal fighters from his tribe, because it's all about tribes. And Al-Shabaab came and, I guess, attacked him in Southwest State in the southern portion of Somalia, and he turned himself into the Somali government. Fun fact, the dude's now running for vice president of Southwest State in Somalia, and he's going to win. This guy's been killing Somalis since, like, 2002, and now he's a front runner for the VP position for Southwest State, which also, since we talked about Eric Prince earlier, fun fact, Eric Prince's Chinese-owned Frontier Services Group has, I think, what, $2.2 billion invested in Southwest State?
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, yeah, I think we've discussed on the show before that Eric Prince and China have been investing money all over Africa, right?
Oh, yeah. That's the thing is, like, we're not paying attention. And this is a huge critique, and I don't care if it's bad. The United States is focused solely on kinetic GWAT operations when they have failed to pay attention to the economic, you know, warfare or, you know, shadow wars that you have going on. China and Russia are doing that. I mean, Russia has a gross national product the size of Italy. We know that. It's just mainly run by mafia folks and just, you know, dictatorship type folks. I mean, that's my opinion.
Yeah, but they figured out really innovative ways to power project in the new world, though.
Right? Yeah, they do. And what do they use? They use social media. They're very good at the ones and zeros of you know, social engineering. I mean, this is active measures. Russia's very good at it. You know, they talk a huge game. They're very good at scare tactics. They play the long chess game. China just stays quiet and buys stuff. I mean, they own 70% of Africa, of which the majority of the precious metals that we use, even in our laptops, computers, cell phones, everything, they come from Africa. Well, China owns a lot of these. They have their fingers in a lot of this stuff, and now they have their first overseas base. Overseas military base ever in China's history is in Africa. It's in Djibouti. They're claiming they set that up to protect the international waterways from their oil terminals in and around, like, Tripoli and Sirte and Libya and things like that. Because, you know, I guess some terrorist organizations – actually, it wasn't a terrorist organization. We don't know if it was – it was Somali pirates that actually hit their boats. And they said, okay, well, we're gonna put a naval base – along with about, I think they have like 250 soldiers, infantry style soldiers at that base. They've also had their first overseas deployment of combat troops to Africa under the auspices of United Nations peacekeepers down. And I think in South Sudan, which is interesting because South Sudan and the Blue Nile, they own a lot of that because that is the most oil rich area in the region. Like Sudan and South Sudan, they're building terminals, they're building train stations, they're train tracks that go from South Sudan all the way to the Southwest State of Somalia's new oil terminal that Frontier Services Group is building for the Chinese. So it's a pretty weird, interesting world. I mean, everybody, the United States missed it. You know, we were too busy focusing on the 10-year kinetic strike, you know, let's bomb it till it acquiesces type of thing, and the other two superpowers that were like, okay, we can't beat them militaristically, kinetically, let's beat them economically.
Well, let's cast our eye back a little bit more.
Yeah, sorry.
No, it's okay. You don't need to apologize. This is just, audience, this is a very loose episode. We're just talking about the kind of the stuff that we missed over the break, getting everyone used to the new voices. We're going to be having, you know, some focused episodes coming up with guests where we're talking to people specifically about, you know, the Syrian withdrawal, as much as anyone knows anything that's going on with it, you know, what's going on in Afghanistan, and some of the classic stuff where we go back and look at history. All that stuff is staying. But, you know, just right now, just these are the new folks, and these are the knowledge base that they're bringing. And I think it's important, and I think it's good. And have you guys looked much? I know that it kind of was happening as we were getting on. Have you looked at the missile defense review that the Pentagon was talking about and publicizing kind of as we were about to jump on?
Yeah, I'm really excited for Star Wars Part Two.
It is a lot like Star Wars, which was, you know, Reagan's proposed missile defense system from space in the 80s. And that's kind of what we're looking at again, right?
Yeah, just with more robots. More robots, we're talking about it in terms of what's cool in the 21st century. But of course, lasers still seem to be very much part of it again.
It's not even a really good script. It's like Star Wars, the original came out, everybody loved it. And then George Lucas is like, well, I just came out with special edition because we got new CGI. I mean, it's not a two, it's not a sequel. It's the same thing. They just added new shit to it. Like what Kevin said, robots, and the lasers are still there. I thought it was funny.
It's basically the same old space defense platform, but now we're going to have F-35 with some sort of interceptor built onto it, supposedly going to take down ICBMs as they're going up, and also drones with lasers doing the same thing. It should be a huge laser to... anyway, there's so many questions. I have so many questions, and we just don't know.
Matt, did you read... Okay, did you see... I think you sent it to me. Did you see Jerry Doyle's Twitter thread of this, right?
Yes.
The writer's... Okay. He breaks it down pretty succinctly, because you have to have... Okay, so ICBMs are traveling, what, 14,000? 6,000 milliseconds?
It depends on when they're going up and when they're coming down. I know when they're
right,
coming... So, down,
when
I think it's about
down,
it's like 7 kilometers a minute or a second.
Yeah,
rather.
It's super fast, and he's saying the only way you're gonna the most opportune time is to intercept these things is when they're climbing, is when they're going up, right? That's when they're supposedly, air quotes, slowest. But he's talking about that you need an intercept. Okay, so we have interceptors. We've got the THAAD system, the AGS system, the Patriot missile system. These aren't really designed to hit ICBMs, but the GMDs are, the ground missile defense systems that are in like Greeley and Alaska and things like that. These are like local. These are only designed to protect, let's say Washington, right? They're like, okay, everyone else is going to get it, because these things aren't designed to, they can't stop a full on thousands of nuclear warheads from let's just say Russia, because we know Russia has a lot of nukes, right? Also, those GMDs, those ground missile defense systems, they're the same size as a Trident 1. They're like a little brother of the Trident, or the intercontinental ballistic missile. These things are huge. So what you're trying to say here is, Guy, and we know who we're talking about, Trump, is that you're going to put a 200 foot long plus, and I'm just being conservative here, missile in an F-30 on an F-35 and expect it to hit it. Now, I would think, like I did a quick search here, and I was like, you know, this is reminding me of the JASSM-ER, the Joint Airstrike Missile Extended Range Missile System that Trump bragged about. Do you guys remember the airstrike in April after the Shea Sartoun in Douma, the Syria? The chemical thing. Okay, yeah. Well, he accidentally tweeted out, like, you know, I'm going to paraphrase, you know, suck it, Russia. We have nice new and smarter bombs. He just kind of let the cat out of the bag that they used the ERXL, the new less than hypersonic cruise missile that its nuclear and nuclear capabilities ambiguous. We could probably put a TAC nuke on it, but these things are designed to like do bullet to bullet. Right, you're trying to hit a bullet with a bullet missile defense interception. And the way that Jerry was breaking it down, basically you have to put a B-1B Lancer within surface-to-air missile range that's up there 24/7 now, because our early warning systems aren't designed enough to get B-1Bs out of Qatar. Let's say
you're talking about kind of going back to the days of Strategic Air Command, where we've got jets and bombers in the air all the time,
yeah,
right around the territories of our quote unquote enemies, right?
Yeah.
But this time it's
F-35s. That's what I'm saying. They're calling F-35s in the new – the B-1B is not new, but the new start – the Lancers have been completely gutted and revamped, right? They're not nuclear capable. But this is why I'm saying it's like the special edition of Star Wars. It's a redux. It's not a new script. They just added new and exciting things to look at. The F-35, the B-1, the JASSM-ER, the THAAD missile system that apparently that's the same thing. It's had limited 5 to 10 limited capability of hitting things, a ballistic missile. But we're really not sure. Like the THAAD missile system was designed to take out. Like the THAAD, the GMD, and the JASSM-ER concepts are all designed to really kind of design around the fact that what if North Korea launches a nuclear missile? That'll be one, right? That's not an all-out mushroom cloud coming Russia attack, right? It's not what they're looking at. These are all designed around like rogue nation states that have nuclear weapons, right?
Right, because you would think in the event of somebody like Russia launching nukes, we're in a position where it's mutually assured destruction, right? It's just, if you're going to do a second strike, you're going to do everything.
Yeah.
So what would be the point of these missile defense measures? Because you probably don't have enough to take down everything that they're going to send.
I don't think they're defensive. I think they're an offensive weapon. I mean, think about it.
No, I think you're right too. And I think that that's one of the dangers of stuff like this is that it pushes a new nuclear, it plays into this new nuclear arms race thing that Russia is also playing into with the hypersonic warheads, right?
Yeah, but are they doing that? Are they doing that to try to goose us the way that Reagan did in the 80s? By starting, I mean, it's almost like we're taking a playbook from Reagan. We're like, hey, let's inadvertently start another arms race. I don't think the United States can. I don't think we have the capital to do that. I think China and China specifically has more than China's. Our economy is tied so closely to China that we're actually paying China. We would actually be paying China in the arms race. We would be giving them money to literally develop their own weapon systems. Now, what I said about Russia's gross national product, legal gross national product, is about the size of Italy. I'm not saying they don't have technological advances. I think what Russia's really kind of focused on is the cyber realm, because if you can shut down SCADA systems, which are online systems that control, I don't know, let's say the power grid or an on-off, the on-off switch for oil, oil pumping or something like infrastructurally, SCADA systems run infrastructure, right?
What's SCADA? Like, spell that out for us.
You're going to have to cut this out. I'm going to look it up. I always say SCADA and SCADA systems. It's a supervisory control and data acquisition computer system. It's basically like the Internet of Things. Those things come to you like, hey, like the Echo or these Amazon Echoes or Siri. So I'm dumbing it down, but these are giant systems that control the flow of power, oil. They're huge industrial computer systems that are dumb. They're not front facing, what we call it's headless. So they don't have like an operating, like a user interface. It's these SCADA systems are designed specifically to do specific automated things. So you see like robots building cars, those are SCADA systems. Those are supervisory control and data acquisition, a computer system gathering, analyzing, just, use real time data, and then you're using it they're basically just workers. They're worker systems. It's like, again, we're talking about robots. They have a specific function. Do you guys remember Stuxnet? What happened in Iran?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
That was a SCADA attack. That was a SCADA systems attack where they were able to change the RPM of the centrifuges at a nuclear power plant. They were able to change the RPM because those things spin with an oblong rod, right? They're agitating. They're a centrifuge, right? If you change the RPM of those, just even by 0.2, 0.3, or even 1, they will spin off axis. Those centrifuges. They will spin off axis, and enough of that vibration will cavitate, and it will basically destroy, or worst case scenario, cause something to explode. Like there's going to be a kinetic response to that. So that's weaponized cyber operations. That's what I feel like Russia has really kind of started to focus on, because honestly, I don't believe that Russia can beat us in a head-to-head fight without using nukes.
But yeah, no, I think you're right. Like, it's all, and this is it. This is interesting, and I think one of the future kind of fronts in war. And I know it's a cliche because we keep saying it over and over again at this point. But the cyber realm is really big and really important, and I don't think that America is adequately prepared for it at all. And I think Russia and China have been.
Not at all. Oh my God! Thank you so much. Not at all. We are awful at this. We are look, there's a small core. We all know where they're at, and they're very good at this. But the issue is that there's an offensive and a defensive cyber operations war. There's warfare going on, and people don't really – they're like traditional warfare is someone shoots a bullet, someone dies, and there's explosions, there's everything else like that. But what I just explained with Stuxnet, that is a digital attack that resulted in a kinetic, you know, end of what they were doing. There's things out there that scare the shit out of me. Like, what happens if Russia or China, and this is worst case scenario, if they owned the entire U.S. power grid or grid in general, they could in essence do a cyber EMP, and we don't have anything that works. We have nothing that works. And then they could just roll in and do whatever they need to do. You know,
is the American power grid really that interconnected?
I think it is. I mean, I've read a lot of art. I think we're so interconnected because we're inherently lazy people. So I think, you know, it's very interconnected. I believe that there's been, since Stuxnet and since some other incidences that's happened in the United States with, like, you know, brownout, unknown reasons of brownouts, and especially in New York City and DC and things like that. I mean, there's a lot of things that are happening. And people can just dismiss it to some 300-pound fat hacker kid living in his mom's basement. I think that right there, that moniker that the Trump administration and a lot of other people agree with, is holistically wrong. I mean, China has an entire island dedicated to cyber operations, an entire island that they actually built in the Hainan.
You're talking about – back up just a second. You're talking about attribution. You're saying that attribution's a little bit easier than people think it is.
Yeah, sorry. Let's use the big word. Yeah, I think it's a lot easier – than people think it is. I think that cybersecurity has been an issue since 2004, and it's been briefed to the Senate Armed Services Oversight Committee since then. It's been, you know, people just don't focus on it. If they don't understand it, the threats that they're used to is this, the Star Wars 2 program. All of a sudden we've got some guy who just thinks that he's living in the 1980s people are going to launch nuclear weapons. That's not what's going to happen. It's going to be a 3, 4, or 5-pronged attack. I mean, nuclear weapons is going to be the last resort of anything. So missile defenses is just I just think it's a boondoggle. Why are we not dumping the trillions of dollars that it's going to take to appease him with, you know, drone sharks with lasers on their heads to try to take out an ICBM traveling at 13 to 14,000 miles per hour on the entry, when we could possibly be in the cybersecurity realm and stop that launch through surreptitious means, offensive and defensive cyber attacks before it even leaves the ground? And that's what China and Russia are doing.
Well, that would require us to have a robust foreign intelligence service, which I'm not sure we do right now, right?
I don't think the fusion cells are working, to be honest with you. I really don't.
What do you mean?
I think the National Security Agency should be running the National Security Agency operation. I don't think that they should be having fusion cells with the Department of Defense, because the Department of Defense feels left out on a lot of things. I think the fusion cells, when they first got together, there was a growing pains right after 9/11. And I think it found its leveling point, its homeostasis, but now there's these new threats. You have a lot of intelligent people at the Office of National Defense National Intelligence that are saying, look, here's the writing on the wall. It's just that we don't have, there's not one entity or one person that can say, okay, across the board on all levels of, in U.S. intelligence services, this is what's, you know, priority. Here's your budget. You know, I think they tried to do that. And I'm specifically talking about, intelligence operations through cyber operations signals intelligence, and I think we've pushed hugely away from human intelligence. I mean, I think it's just become, we've become kind of lazy with the fact that, you know, we're in Afghanistan or we're in Iraq or Syria. I mean, I don't think we're looking past that. So no, I agree with you. I don't think we have a robust U.S. intelligence apparatus. I think it's conflicted.
You're right. It's like we've been focusing on the forever war for so long that we've lost sight of any kind of long-term planning at all.
I don't think we can. I think we've been reactionary, Matt, for about 17 years.
Mm-hmm.
I really do.
Well, I think that's a really great and depressing place to end this introductory episode of War College, which is usually how we do. So some aspects of the show aren't going to change. But we will be back next week with a new episode with a guest where we're all going to be sitting and talking to them. And I hope the audience comes along with us. I hope you like the new stuff, and I hope you keep listening.
Yeah, this will be a good time, I think.
Yeah, this is going to be really good. That's this week's episode of War College. Thank you so much for listening. Back to regular business next week. We're going to be talking to some people about what the hell is going on in Syria. I think you guys are going to enjoy the show. Derek's got a lot of experience. Kevin has a lot of knowledge. They're going to bring a little bit of a different voice to the show, but I'm excited. War College is me, Matthew Galt, and Derek Gannon. Of course, Kevin Nodell is the associate producer. We will be back next week. If you like the show, please like and subscribe. Leave us a review on iTunes and follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/warcollegepodcast, on Twitter at war_college, or on the web at warcollege.co. And we will see you next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.